They say heartbreak breaks you open. But what if that heartbreak was never an accident, but a design? My name is Narrator's Name, and this is the story of how I was emotionally engineered by a master manipulator. My pain was studied. My silence was coded. My trust was converted into data. This isn't just about love gone wrong. This is about how heartbreak became a weapon, and how I turned it into a war cry. Welcome to Manipulation, the profound impact of heartbreak in human psychology. If you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform now, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. The smile that started the spiral. It's strange what the mind decides to hold on to. Not the first kiss, not the first fight, but the smile. That smile, the one that looked so safe, it almost felt like home. I remember the exact moment. I was standing in the museum's art exploration wing, staring at a PS1-era pixelated video installation that looped on a cracked CRT monitor. A visual metaphor for memory, the curator claimed. It was all static and sound distortion. I should have known right then, distortion was foreshadowing. He stood next to me and asked, "Do you think pain can be beautiful?" I laughed, nervously. The kind of laugh you let out when your mind is racing to figure out how to respond without giving too much of yourself away. He smiled, said, "I only ask questions like that to people I know are hiding something." That was the moment I fell. Or, got pulled. I had just left a toxic job. Work dynamics had drained me dry, gaslighting bosses, performative wellness campaigns, a manager who weaponized ethical standards until they just felt like another brand value to exploit. I was floating through life with no anchor, no identity, and he walked in like gravity. We talked about everything that day. Behavioral psychology, market psychology, the art of knowing your audience. He said he was fascinated by social manipulation and how group behavior dictated consumer patterns more than logic ever could. I was fascinated by him, not just for what he said, but how he said it. He had this hypnotic rhythm to his voice, deep, methodical. His words felt like they were engineered stories, not spontaneous ones. I couldn't tell if I was being listened to or profiled. He told me he was a transformation architect. I didn't know what that meant, still don't. He said it involved cognitive psychology, market dynamics, and helping people reach their full potential by unlocking their true body intelligence. He told me most people's hearts beat for survival, not truth, and that he was one of the few capable of showing the difference. I believed him. The next day, he sent me an audio file. "Listen to this alone," his text read. I pressed play. His voice filled my headphones, calm, steady, instructive. He described breathing techniques, guided reflections, and asked me questions about my past relationships, my deepest fears, even my mother. Audio manipulation. I didn't know that term back then, but I felt something shift. My thoughts didn't feel entirely mine anymore. By week two, we were inseparable. We spent nights talking about ethical leadership, persuasion methods, and how some people are just wired for dark forces. He never said whether he meant himself. I told him I'd been cheated on. He listened too well. He nodded in the right places, squeezed my hand, and whispered things like, "It was never your fault, and you were always too rare for the average man." Those words cracked me open. What I didn't realize was, those words were tools and tactics. He introduced me to his friends, a network of influencers, coaches, NLP practitioners, and artists who all seem to echo the same phrases. Lead with alignment. Energy doesn't lie. Pain is just information. I started writing them down. I thought I was evolving. In reality, I was being downloaded. Social dynamics dressed as spirituality. One night, I found him pacing our apartment, barefoot, shirtless, muttering about someone betraying him in a Telegram chat group. He said someone tried to expose him, that someone had tracked his offshore accounts, accusing him of funneling client payments from trauma healing retreats into cryptocurrency chains. I asked if it was true. He smiled. "Would you really leave me over someone else's fear of freedom?" I didn't know what that meant. I just knew he'd turned the question into a trap. My stomach dropped when I first saw the server room. We had driven to a co-working hub he said he used for sensitive backups. The air was cold. He entered a small room filled with cables, blinking routers, and a screen with psychology tips stored in what looked like surveillance software. One folder was titled, "Triggers, My Name." My knees buckled. He caught me. "This is how I learned to love better," he whispered. Dark psychology painted as devotion. That night, I slept in the guest room. And by slept, I mean, I replayed every moment we'd shared. I started seeing the pattern, the art techniques he used to construct his persona, the market emotions he mirrored, the exact phrases he'd said to me that I had seen in self-help forums he moderated under aliases. My world wasn't just shaken. It was fabricated. And then the phone rang. A woman's voice. "You don't know me. But I think we've been in love with the same lie." That was the moment the spiral stopped feeling romantic. It started feeling like war. Data is fluid. She called herself Ray. Her voice had the kind of composure that only came from destruction. "He recorded you. He did it to me too. He said it was for body intelligence study. It's a lie. You're not alone. I'm sorry to say that, but you need to know. I didn't cry. I didn't scream. I sat perfectly still, staring at the soft blue glow of my phone screen, thinking about every time I'd undressed in that apartment. Every time I'd confessed my secrets to the blinking red dot on his vintage PS1 webcam, the one he called aesthetic. Data is fluid. That was his mantra. I remembered the way he'd say it, usually right before showing me one of his data maps on relationships. Arrows. Names. Color-coded bubbles with labels like emotional leverage, persuasion method, unconscious loyalty, and reliability rupture. I had thought it was an abstract art project. Turns out I was the centerpiece. That same night, I snuck into his laptop. Password was still my birthday. I found folders with video thumbnails. I clicked the first, Ray. Naked. Crying. Same script, same camera angle. The file name was descent_7.mp4. I stopped breathing. The second was mine. Descent_12. I scrubbed through it. Silent tears ran down my face. Not from what I saw, but from what I remembered feeling when it was happening. The exact moment I thought I was breaking down in private, safe in the arms of someone I thought understood me. He wasn't comforting me. He was documenting me. Every interaction between us was indexed, cross-referenced by market dynamics. When I was most agreeable, when I craved touch, when my voice dropped, he had graphs. I wasn't a girlfriend. I was a psychological case study designed for his content funnel. Buried deeper in his external drive were screenshots of conversations with what looked like investors. He was selling an audio manipulation platform, a predictive intimacy engine based on cognitive psychology and trauma-based trust modeling. I wasn't the only one recorded. He had nearly 24 case files, each labeled by emotion, rage, shame, euphoria, apathy. My hands were shaking so badly I dropped the laptop. He heard. He walked in slow, barefoot again, his shadow trailing down the hallway. "You're looking where you don't belong." He said it with disappointment, not fear. Like a parent catching a child playing with matches. "You don't understand how powerful this work is. You just feel things. That's not intelligence. That's chaos." I said nothing. I just stared. I had no tools to fight him, not yet. But I documented everything. Every file name. Every phrase. Every shadowed secret. The next morning I was gone. I moved into a friend's place across the city. I didn't tell anyone what happened. Not yet. I needed proof. And I needed perspective. So I did what I always did when I had no answers. I started researching. I took a deep dive into NLP techniques, dark psychology, group behavior modeling, cognitive techniques, and market psychology. I read blogs by whistleblowers, ex-pickup artists, and behavioral engineers who had flipped sides. I joined underground forums of women sharing nearly identical stories. Charisma weaponized, vulnerability recorded, manipulated, monetized. Some men in these groups called themselves conscious engineers. Others? Flat-out con artists. But they didn't hide it. One even posted a video dissecting a TED talk about ethical leadership, and then admitted how easy it was to mirror it and bend weak minds toward profitable outcomes. It made me sick, but also focused. I took courses. I taught myself psychology tips, persuasion resistance strategies, even exam techniques to pass modules on behavioral science. I began journaling the manipulation patterns and filed them under a project I called Shadowed Truths. One night, Ray invited me to a private gathering, a game exploration and healing circle for survivors of manipulation cults and emotional exploiters. They called themselves the Mitigators. There, I met Olivia, a lawyer who lost her job after her firm's partner and lover drained her bank account and disappeared with funds moved through Panama-based offshore accounts. And Sasha, who'd been part of a ski-based influencer retreat he hosted years ago, supposedly about ski techniques as metaphors for leadership dynamics. She showed me the scars from that trip. Not physical, emotional. And yet, every woman had something he gave them. A charm, a phrase, a feeling they still missed. That's the thing about social manipulation. It doesn't steal your trust. It convinces you to hand it over like a gift. That week, I recorded my own audio. My voice. My story. Raw. Unfiltered. I uploaded it anonymously under the podcast tag, Shadows of Justice. I didn't expect anything, but it blew up. Overnight, thousands of plays. Messages from strangers. One even said, "Your voice stopped me from marrying my manipulator." I cried so hard I couldn't stand. It was the first time heartbreak didn't consume me, it converted me. I wasn't just a case study anymore. I was a story, my story. And I was about to turn it into a weapon. The sketch that shattered me. Some wounds don't bleed. They hang in galleries. They live in frames. It had been weeks since I'd left him. Since the server room. Since Ray. Since my anonymous podcast, Shadows of Justice, exploded. I was trying to keep myself small again. Stay off his radar. But one afternoon, a box arrived. No return address. My name handwritten in that same looping script he used when he wrote me poems during our first month together. For a moment, my chest actually fluttered. I still hadn't untrained my body from craving him. I opened the box slowly. Inside, tissue paper. And beneath it, a frame. A sketch. Pencil on thick paper. No color. Just black and shadow. It was me. Naked. Kneeling. Crying. My hair tangled, shoulders trembling. An exact replication of the night I collapsed on the kitchen floor, hyperventilating after he disappeared for 3 days without explanation. I had begged him not to leave me again. I remember the words I sobbed that night. And there, in graphite, were those words scribbled in tiny cursive beneath the drawing. "Please just tell me it meant something." I dropped the frame. I didn't scream. I didn't cry. I stared. Because in that moment, I realized this wasn't a keepsake. This was a weaponized memory. This was art exploration turned into trauma pornography. The next morning, I posted the image, not publicly, but in the mitigator's encrypted thread. Within an hour, three other women posted versions of their own. He'd done the same to them. Sketches. Photos. Framed visual grief. Each woman had received theirs after leaving him. This wasn't love. This was a signature. A calling card for a con artist who engineered stories through others' pain and then immortalized it. One survivor, Camila, wrote, "He once told me that capturing a woman in her most broken state was a form of divine aesthetics. That it was the only way to mirror true human emotion back into society." Another wrote, "He told me my collapse was art. My sobbing was a poem. My fear was an energetic release. That day, I finally let rage move through me. The kind of rage that makes your vision vibrate. I wasn't just manipulated. I was curated. I went back through everything he had ever sent me. PDFs on cognitive techniques, psychology tips, emotional tracking software, and articles he swore helped him better love. All of it plagiarized. Many from seduction forums. Others from obscure market psychology manuals. His brilliance was in arrangement, not origin. He knew how to stack ideas, dress them in empathy, and deliver them through the soft velvet of trust. He even called it that once. Soft velvet of trust. That's where persuasion becomes divine." I spent 2 weeks creating a dossier, his phrases, his sketches, screenshots, his alias accounts, financial documents, and most damning, links to offshore accounts used to process coaching payments through PayPal clones and cryptocurrency wallets with fake business names. He ran a course titled Mastering Leadership Through Emotional Collapse. He was teaching people how to break others open for market conversion. I reached out to an investigative podcast network. I sent everything. They didn't hesitate. 1 month later, the episode aired. The Velvet Trap. Within 48 hours, 5 more survivors reached out. Within 72, he went dark. No social posts. No workshops. His website was replaced with a 404. But I knew that wasn't the end. People like him don't vanish. They evolve. One night, I got a call from a blocked number. I didn't answer. A voicemail followed. "Your little movement is cute. But chaos is a mirror, and you're starting to resemble me. I won't lie. I almost deleted everything. The podcast. The posts. The dossier. That's what complex emotions do, they spiral. They fracture clarity. But then I remembered something Ray had told me. A manipulator's greatest fear isn't exposure. It's being interpreted by someone who can't be seduced." That week, I recorded a second season. Not just my story. There's two. We talked about dark forces, market emotions, PS1 nostalgia triggers, even body language in abusive coaching environments. we interviewed behavioral psychologists, financial analysts who explained how charm masks financial fraud. I titled the season, From Seduction to Strategy. We dissected every mitigation technique. We taught cognitive skills. We redefined positive influence. And most importantly, we began to rewrite the rules of what true leadership looks like. The sketch still hangs in my closet. I kept it, not as a scar, but as a receipt, a signature of a manipulator who thought I'd never find my voice. And now, that voice plays in the ears of women everywhere who once thought their breakdowns made them weak. Turns out, we were just warming up. Behind the seminar smile, I wasn't supposed to be there. Not as myself. Not as the woman he had once whispered poems to in the dark. Not as the subject of his sketch. I had a new name, a forged conference badge, a different haircut and contacts that made my eyes a shade lighter. My posture had changed too. I'd studied body language, mastered what confidence looked like even when my insides were a civil war. The venue was a rebranded event space in Midtown. Faux Zen lighting, glass walls, branded gift bags filled with journal prompts, lavender oil, and QR codes linking to something he called true body intelligence frameworks. I almost laughed out loud. It was the same man. New words. New lies. I scanned the crowd. Mostly women. Young. A few men, dressed in designer sweats and wellness gear. The chairs were arranged in concentric circles. Open flow architecture, they called it. I called it social manipulation geometry. Then he stepped out. Same posture. Same controlled breath. Same smile. The seminar smile. It didn't touch his eyes. It never had. His shirt was half unbuttoned, sleeves rolled just so. He wore a thin bracelet engraved with something that looked spiritual, but was probably a subtle marketing symbol, a persuasion method disguised as philosophy. He welcomed the room. His voice still had that careful pitch modulation. He'd mastered audio manipulation. Every inflection was calculated to generate emotional trust, to match a market dynamic he'd tested in private beta groups. I recognized some of the phrasing from the plagiarized forums. Emotions are not chaos, they're code. Shadows are just unlit truths. Collapse is the first step of mastery. I wasn't there to listen. I was there to extract, to gather evidence, to expose his new scam. But halfway through his opening monologue, I watched a woman across the circle. She was biting her lip, eyes wide, writing feverishly in her notebook. I knew that look. It was the same expression I had the night he told me pain was an invitation to higher consciousness. That's when I knew this wasn't a seminar. It was a recruitment, market psychology in motion. He invited the group to break off into triads for a somatic reflection drill. I was paired with a woman named Eden. She was an artist. Lost her partner 2 months ago. She whispered, "I didn't think anyone here would understand." But when he spoke, I felt like he read my grief before I even opened my mouth. I didn't answer. I just nodded. My inside screamed. We returned to the group. He moved through the circle, touching shoulders, offering gentle affirmations. He stopped in front of me, tilted his head. "Have we met?" My throat locked. I smiled, the kind of smile you rehearse for exam techniques in courtrooms when you're suppressing trauma behind mascara and lipstick. "Only in dreams," I whispered. He smirked, then moved on. I had to leave. I couldn't stay another minute without revealing myself. But I made it to the exit and snapped a photo of the whiteboard, his business model scrawled across it like a startup pitch. Terms like ethical marketing funnel, body collapse trust arc, mitigation bait loops. It was all there. Dark psychology dressed in ethical leadership branding. That night, I posted the image anonymously. It went viral. Comments flooded in, former clients, therapists, ex-colleagues. One user, a former software engineer, shared that he had helped code the back end of the Celestial Insights app, which secretly recorded microphone inputs during journaling exercises. He had no idea the data was being used for psychological profiling. The app was pulled from the store the next morning. He emailed me that night. I didn't know how he knew it was me. The subject line just said, "We could have led together." I wanted to delete it, but something about that sentence, it made my skin crawl because it was familiar. It was what he told Ray and Sasha and Olivia, a repeat phrase, part of his emotional schema. I forwarded it to my contacts at the investigative podcast. We decided it was time to take things further. A documentary. Visual evidence. His entire timeline from art techniques to financial abuse, from server rooms to spiritual retreat fraud, from PS1 nostalgia events to offshore account laundering. The final segment of the seminar was live streamed. We stitched in overlays, testimonials, red flags. The audio feed layered his voice over our edits, juxtaposed with victims reading their letters. It was released as Behind the Seminar Smile, How Charisma Becomes a Crime Scene. And this time, it wasn't just viral. It was legal. Lawsuits were filed. Sponsors pulled out. One platform even took down all of his content, citing violations of ethical standards and use of user data without consent. That was the night I felt my chest expand in a way it hadn't in months. I wasn't healed, but I was free of the illusion. And that was enough to start breathing again. The other women, I used to think my story was rare. That my pain was unique, singular. That what he did to me was an exception. Then I met them, the others. We called ourselves the 12. We met in an encrypted video room, hosted by a digital rights nonprofit. Faces from all over, New York, Barcelona, Melbourne, Cape Town. Different races, backgrounds, faiths. But the same tremble when we said his name. The same shame in our chests. And eventually the same fire in our eyes. Olivia, the lawyer. Camila, the dancer. Ray, the one who first called me. Eden, from the seminar. She found me after the live stream went public. And then, Sasha. Sasha had a different piece of the puzzle. She dated him back in 2016, during what he called his art monk phase. She showed us photos from his old workshop, cluttered with sketches, photos, diagrams, and something that stopped all of us cold. A corkboard, covered in yarn and pins. Names. Ours. I leaned in. There it was, my face, printed in black and white. My name written in red ink. Underneath it. Test subject, EM_12. Affinity validation. Trigger, abandonment. Manipulation level, advanced. My whole body seized. This wasn't just personal. This was engineering. He had created a database, a social dynamics system built on real women, real pain, and real cognitive techniques pulled from forums, journals, even exam technique research from behavioral labs. He used our weaknesses like sliders on a control panel, adjusting praise, withdrawal, touch, silence. A manipulator, yes. But more than that, an emotional programmer. The files Sasha uncovered referenced something called the Mirror Network. It was a term he'd coined in a blog post years ago, where he talked about using body intelligence and market emotions to amplify intimacy using synthetic feedback loops. We found video footage of his so-called practice runs, clips of him conducting mock coaching calls where he mirrored the person so precisely it bordered on digital possession. We dug deeper. Ray found screenshots of a web app prototype hosted under a domain named celestialdashboard.io. We cracked the login. Inside, full emotional breakdowns, audio logs, engagement scores, risk assessments labeled things like likely to expose, easier reentry, and high leverage grief. I sat in silence for a long time. I remembered how he used to wake me up at 2 a.m. just to ask how I felt, how I thought it was romantic. He wasn't listening. He was recording pattern fluctuations. My sobs, my silences, were just data points. This was social manipulation under the guise of spiritual coaching. Work dynamics in the shape of seduction. Dark psychology served with herbal tea and back rubs. The 12 of us formed a task force. We called it the Archive. We weren't just survivors now. We were documentarians of every lie he ever told. We submitted files to legal advisors, investigative reporters, and financial crime units. The offshore accounts were traced. Some were connected to shell nonprofits labeled Art for Empathy and Leadership Light Code. We tracked the money to three countries. But the most disturbing discovery came from Olivia. She uncovered a private Discord server where he mentored others. Dozens of men, calling him sensei. Some paid thousands for his mentorship. They called the process the sculpting. It included steps like tear and cradle, install divine scarcity, introduce shadowed truth, use celestial insights during collapse, and integrate identity degradation through skill praise. We were horrified, but also validated. Our pain was no longer a question. It was proof. The Archive partnered with a digital collective to build a public-facing tool, a reverse lookup where women could search quotes, messages, even gestures, and get matched to potential emotional predators who used the same tactics. We called it the Velvet Pattern. Within a month, we had over 60 submissions. More women. Same stories. Same voice recordings. Same empty eyes. But what broke me wasn't the new names. It was the last one. My sister. She was in college when we stopped speaking. I thought she'd ghosted me during my breakdown. But she hadn't. He had. He dated her under a different name. 5 years before he met me. He used everything I told him about her, her trauma, her insecurities, to pull her in. She'd ended up hospitalized after a panic attack. Never told anyone who caused it. Not until now. That night, I listened to her cry through the phone for 2 hours. And then I cried too. The kind of cry that doesn't come from sadness, but from rage, clarity, and loss so ancient it feels like birth. I promised her we would burn it all down. And for the first time in months, I meant it. Because I wasn't just one of the women anymore. I was one of the other women. And we were no longer afraid of the mirror. Shadows of justice. The courtroom didn't feel like a place of truth. It felt like a stage. Polished wood. Glass reflections. And in the middle, him. Still smiling. Still dressed in linen and charm. Still performing. He sat between his two lawyers like he was being auditioned for a Netflix biopic. He knew how to engineer stories, after all. And court was just a narrative with stakes. They charged him with wire fraud, emotional abuse under commercial pretenses, financial manipulation through coaching programs, and violation of digital privacy laws tied to his audio manipulation platform. But what they didn't charge him with, what they couldn't, was the erosion of self. The way he rewrote reality. The way he left you gasping in your own body, questioning what was true and what was crafted. I sat on the witness bench. I wasn't alone. 4 of the 12 gave statements that week. And every time one of us spoke, he'd lean forward, tilt his head like a curious professor, and smile. That smile wasn't empathy. It was control. Even in handcuffs. Tell the truth, the judge had said. But what is the truth when your mind has been redesigned, when your body language has been trained to submit, when your complex emotions have been indexed and monetized? When it was my turn to speak, I froze. My eyes locked on his. And just for a moment, I felt that old twitch in my gut. The one that made me feel like I was being watched through the lens of cognitive psychology, market dynamics, and persuasion methods. I took a breath. And then I broke the spell. I didn't give them just facts. I gave them the human cost. I told them how he'd built a server room of secrets, how he mirrored our pain into art techniques, how he weaponized positive influence until we bled hope and begged for more. I told them about Ray, about Olivia, about Sasha and Eden and my sister. I told them about the sketch and the seminar smile and the velvet pattern and the offshore accounts hidden beneath nonprofit cloaks like true leadership ascension. But most of all, I told them about the way he looked at me when I broke down, like it was beautiful, like it was a climax in his game exploration. And I said it clearly for the judge and jury and cameras. He didn't fall in love with me. He designed me. And when I broke, he called it art. The courtroom went still. Outside, protesters gathered. Some were survivors. Others were students from his former courses. A few still defended him, accused us of overreacting, of trying to cancel masculine power. I realized then that society manipulation doesn't die in court. It mutates. It finds new hosts. But not everyone was blind. A former follower came forward with financial records, proving he'd transferred payments through crypto wallets masked as ski technique retreats and PS1 inner child reconnections. It was absurd, but also real and undeniable. The final testimony came from my sister. She wore a black blazer and no makeup. She trembled, but she didn't fall. He stole my ability to trust silence, she said. He used my grief like a script. She paused, then added, but my sister gave it back to me. I didn't cry in that moment, but something inside me, something I thought had died, began to rebuild. Not joy, not closure, something older, something like true leadership. The verdict was read 2 days later. Guilty on all commercial charges, not guilty on the charges of emotional harm. The court couldn't prove it crossed a criminal line, just a moral one. Shadows of justice. That's what it felt like. Not full, not bright, just enough light to keep him from doing it again, but not enough to erase what had already been done. I walked out of that courtroom and into a swarm of reporters. I said nothing, just held up my phone, played a clip from my podcast. Manipulation isn't always a weapon you see. Sometimes it's the hug you've waited your whole life for, delivered by someone who already knows how you'll fall apart. That night we held a vigil, not for him, but for us. We read letters from survivors, lit candles, projected quotes from his coaching manuals onto the side of a building. Then we shattered the projector with a brick. It was symbolic, but also necessary. I went home alone, sat in the dark, opened my notebook and wrote the words. Justice isn't a verdict. It's the story you tell afterward. The the truth that belongs to me. I thought justice would feel louder, like thunder, like sirens, but it was quiet, like an exhale I didn't realize I'd been holding for years. The night after the verdict, I turned off every screen in my apartment. I lit a single candle, sat in the middle of my floor, and I didn't speak. I didn't journal. I didn't record. For the first time since he'd said, "You're different," I allowed myself to be silent. And in that silence, I met myself again, not the version he curated, not the woman from the sketch, not the podcast voice, just me, with all the pieces that had been manipulated, sold, silenced, triggered, studied, sketched, programmed, returned. One by one, that night I had a dream. I was standing in a server room, surrounded by cables and static. But instead of fear, I felt clarity. I pulled the plugs one by one, and when the last screen blinked out, I saw my reflection, not on a monitor, but in glass. For the first time, it didn't look like data. It looked like a woman. I began writing again. Not reports. Not evidence. A book. The profound impact of heartbreak, unexplored emotions. Not just my story, but a study in how human emotions, cognitive skills, and ethical leadership are reshaped through pain. I wrote about cognitive psychology, dark psychology, NLP techniques, and emotional engineering, not to fear them, but to educate. I taught women how to spot social manipulation disguised as charm, how to decode market psychology disguised as spiritual coaching, how to reclaim their true body intelligence and sharpen their behavioral intuition like armor. I started teaching again, this time in person. Workshops titled Reclaim the Mirror, Ethical Influence Without Exploitation, and Tools and Tactics for Trauma-Safe Leadership. Women flew in from 7 countries to attend the first one. I remember looking out at their faces, some tearful, some still closed, all radiant with unfolding. That was the moment I knew. He didn't win. He'd made us feel small so he could feel powerful. But power isn't in control. It's in choice. And we chose to survive. We chose to speak. We chose to lead differently. One morning, I got an email from a girl named Mira. She was 17. She'd found my podcast after her mentor started pushing her to do collapse rituals to build emotional resilience. She left before the damage. Because she listened. Because she learned. Because someone warned her. That someone was me. And in that moment, I realized something no court could affirm. Truth doesn't need permission. It just needs protection. The media eventually moved on. So did some of the survivors. The podcast slowed down. But my purpose didn't. I turned Shadows of Justice into a nonprofit focused on survivor-led content creation and ethical marketing education. We offered psychology tips, free access to mitigation techniques, and grants for art by those rebuilding their voices. We even held a memorial exhibit. The theme was Broken Isn't the End. I included the sketch he sent me, not as a trophy, as evidence. And beside it, I posted my own sketch of a woman standing tall, holding a match. The caption read, "This time I'm the artist." People cried in front of that piece. But I didn't, because I had cried enough. And finally, my tears had turned to ink. In the final chapter of the book, I wrote this. To all the women who've been studied instead of loved, decoded instead of held, mirrored instead of honored, this is for you. You are not a project. You are not a lesson. You are not an algorithm to exploit. You are art. Living, breathing, untamed art. And no one gets to sign your pain but you. That truth. That uncompromised, unapologetic, unthemed truth. That belongs to me. And no one can take it again.